mic check.
Everyone got one. What's your opinion? This is the rare one. Tongues won't be bitten. Ain't no rules, just spill it. And anybody can get it. No limit, we get to kill it. You tuning into the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping.
No.
Any topic, even the random.
We get to win.
I hope that you ready. We entering in the zone soon. We on a grown shit. Welcome to the rare one.
That's it. That's all I got to say.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest. Look at my guest, like an MG.
You're so giddy today.
And you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it street, we keep it opinionated, and we keep it what? You gonna do it again on me?
No, I'm just saying, I just want the audience to know that Hilliard bought himself a brand new shiny gold microphone.
It is not gold.
And well, from where I'm sitting, and the light from the sun is reflecting off of it, and it looks really golden over there.
It's silver.
It's pretty.
Is it silver?
It's silver.
Is it silver?
It's silver from my angle, but it is.
Yeah, blind. It's like over here, it looks kind of like a goldy color. It goes
with my ring that we haven't discussed yet. My partner proposed to me last week.
Oh, look at you. But I just want to make that observation to the audience.
It's just platinum. Don't worry about it. It's nothing. You know.
Color coordinated.
No, we've been talking about forever that I was going to get a fourth mic, because sometimes we have writing partners come on or whatever and they have to share a mic, and I was like, fuck it, I'll just go get one. So I thought I was going to get the same one. It turns out they don't have them anymore.
They don't make those anymore.
So I had to get...
So you have to have the special one.
That's the story he's telling. I bet you if I was to go to that place right now and walk in like, do you have any more? Oh, yeah, we got a whole plethora. And I'm going to be like,
no, I asked for that one because I had to spend more money on this one.
And if we have a writing partner feud, it's harder to separate us out, too.
That's all right. Exactly. I'll just take a picture of it and walk around like, do you have this?
So y'all know how we do it on the Rant Room. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture. But our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and what else?
Shit like that. Yes, people.
Since she didn't do the 2015.
Oh, because I'm so blinded by the bling of your microphone over there.
Maybe you shouldn't be looking at me.
See?
So that's my girl, Lisa Bolacaja.
Hi, everybody.
We call her the street nerdist.
Yes.
Why we call you that?
Well, because at most times I'm really quite nerdy, but when people just come at me in a certain way, I'll get street real quick. I will pull out the 45. You know, I'm talking about the beer. The dangling cigarette, you know, that kind of thing. So it's like, look, we're just going to bring you some real honest goodness. And yeah, that's all. That's all. It's with love. I know people hear that and they think, oh my God, she just sounds so tough and crazy. Like, no, I'm really a loving and really, really nice person.
She pretended.
I am great.
Mm-hmm.
Just come at me wrong and see what happens.
Exactly. That's her. Anyway, and I am your host, Hilliard Guest. So if you're grown, let's get it in.
Mm-hmm.
So we got some cool guests here today. Really, really cool. Some two people that I met at the Writers Guild. We both are on the education committee. All of us are on the education committee. I'm so used to talking to one of
you. I know, it's like, and the other person's not there. All right.
We got my girl, Cynthia Riddle. Do you go by Cindy?
I do.
So we'll
Cynthia
call you Cindy.
Cynthia used to be when I was in trouble. But I run under Cynthia because it's my big person name.
Oh, okay.
All right. And then my man, Peter, how you say it? Hunziker?
Well, yeah.
Hunziker?
Any way you want.
What is that?
What is it?
That's a great name.
Swiss?
Oh, it's a great name.
Yeah, yeah.
You say it like it's like, you say it with such disdain. It's Swiss. Like, it's like, oh, it's like Gouda cheese. It's like Gouda. It's like, no, it's,
exactly.
It's a great name. Do you know what it means, perchance? Like, do you know the origin?
It has something to do with raising hunting dogs.
Huh.
Ooh.
Interesting. That's all I can tell you.
Well, okay, I may have to use it as a character name.
There's a little town near Lucerne, Switzerland called Hunziken.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Do I assume that that's where the
okay.
Family?
It's just a bus stop.
His family
went to try to find it, and all
sounds
it is a bus stop.
No, I love the etymology of names. So whenever I see really cool, unusual names, one, I always like to know where it comes from and like always ask me, do you know the meaning of it? And plus, I'm a writer, and I steal names. That's what I do.
I
steal them. And a lot of times I like to know the meaning of names, even if I don't use it in a short story or script or explain it.
Mm-hmm.
That subtext, that symbolism is there for me as a writer.
Yeah,
so I love
names.
Yeah, it's like they may not know what it means, but I know what it means.
I find naming your characters too is a lot easier than having children to name or animals or pets to walk to name.
Yes.
So, yeah, there you go.
That's funny.
Awesome.
Use up all those great names and, you know,
you kill off your character if you don't like it. You can't do that with your pet.
Yeah, I have, I have a name journal. When I see really great names during the day, I just write it down. Like, I have a bunch
and
of
we have,
names.
My partner and I, we've been together for 13 and a half years.
Woo-hoo.
And we have the gayest dog names. Malibu and Venice.
It's like the pretty areas of town. Yeah. Okay, you know.
But I mean, it's obvious. We'd be walking down the street with our dogs. And what's your dog's name? Malibu and Venice. And people are like, oh, they're so gay.
Now, do they Malibu. Have appropriate Come on, Malibu. Attitudes for their
Yeah,
names?
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. so. You know, the Malibu's a black one. And they're like little terriers, kind of like the little Fraser dog. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is Venice. And she's just like the sweetest, you know, little one. But she'll fight you, though. She's yeah. like Lisa.
Malibu's hilarious, though, mm-hmm. because... Malibu's got like this really weird wiry hair, mm-hmm. and it doesn't
and
matter.
It looks
you,
gray, but it's white.
Yeah, no matter if you yeah. brush it or do whatever, it's gonna do what it wants to do. Mm-hmm. I love that. Such a sweet.
And hair. I always want to groom her little ass, mm-hmm. but Scott is like, no, leave her hair alone because it gets all mushy and it like falls in her eyes. And I'm like, can we cut that shit so she can see? And he's like, no. And I'm
she
like,
looks fabulous. We're here. For
I'm a Virgo. I want to make that shit perfect.
Who cares the dog can see or not? You know,
exactly.
She's fabulous.
We had a dog named Kim. Killer, who unfortunately, you know, passed away from old age last year, but mm-hmm. he was a little teeny tiny Pomeranian. It was the irony of the name.
Yeah. Oh,
but he had this really fierce bark. Like uh-huh. when he was a little puppy, the UPS man showed up at the door and was like, took a step back and was really terrified when I opened the door expecting, he said, I was expecting a Rottweiler, and it was this
funny.
Little ball of fur.
I was expecting a 120-pound dog.
Yeah.
So, like I said, we have Cindy and Peter on here. Their resume is crazy. It's ridiculous. I mean, you guys have done some really, really cool stuff. I'm just going to punch up a couple things just so they know who the hell we're talking to. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know y'all, like I know y'all, like I heard about y'all, like I read about y'all, shit like that. So we're talking about they're both graduates of UCLA Film School. Mm-hmm. Both have BAs and MAs and MAs. What's it, MA? MMA?
They MFA. Fight?
Is that what it is? Y'all,
Masters
MMAs?
Of Fine Arts.
I didn't go to college, you know what I'm saying? I keep it ghetto with y'all.
MFA just means you're going to make a lot less money than if you had an MBA. That's the bottom line.
Okay.
Your business. And
all right. So they both have MFAs, MBAs in screenwriting and film production, stuff like that. Peter is also a director, right?
Yep.
And you directed some cool stuff that's won you some good stuff.
Yeah.
Tell me
about
that just a little bit on the side note.
Well, one of the early things I did was a short when I was at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
That was for the Coca-Cola Refreshing Filmmakers contest.
Okay.
And I won. It was the first winner from UCLA.
Really?
So I got to see my film actually playing in 14,000 screens
wow.
nationwide, which was pretty
like
cool.
Like for 7 weeks in the middle of summer during like before all the blockbuster films
yes.
like that
year.
It was Pearl Harbor and Moulin Rouge and some cool films like that.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, it was great. What was that about?
Well, I'll give you...
Just give me the cliff notes version.
It's probably longer than the actual 50-second film, but... It's about a woman who lives out in the middle of nowhere in a trailer, and mm-hmm. she likes to watch game shows all day long. And we're watching her watch this game show, and she's answering these ridiculously impossible questions, one after the other, perfectly. She's mm-hmm. brilliant. And she's completely delusional, so when she thinks she got them all right, she thinks she won $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then the punchline is she rewinds the tape and she starts again, and this is just what she does all day long.
This was back when VHS was a thing.
But it's actually funnier yeah. now that it's not a thing, you know.
Wow. That's right. So you probably seen it as much as you go to the movies.
Oh, God.
She one of them cinephiles, y'all.
So. Oh, yeah. I love well, movies.
The woman we got to play it, who's now become a very good friend, mm-hmm. is...
Cindy produced it, by the way.
Yeah, so. I was going to say I was involved in my own way on that one. The woman is, shall we say, kind of Melissa McCarthy-esque, half gay, okay. and one of the funniest, you know, comic actresses around too.
Mm-hmm.
And she does this whole dance when she tells her husband she's won $1 million and throws popcorn up in the air, and it's like this whole big thing. Mm. So it really kind of accentuates the fact when you realize that she's kooky.
Yeah, it's just an exercise in extreme delusion.
Mm. Okay.
Yes.
And also, you guys have written and produced projects for like CBS, Hallmark, Hall of Fame, Lifetime, Showtime, MGM, Stars. I mean, I keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back and talk about how you guys got into the game and how you guys became writing partners, if you don't, really quick.
When
That's
I was,
enough.
Sure.
No, yeah.
We don't do really quick.
You know, because you got to do something to put yourself through film school. When I was mm-hmm. In the MFA program at UCLA, I was also working for a computer software company.
Okay.
I was in charge of their VP of marketing, and I used to travel around the country and do trade shows, and I also did videos for them, you know, promo. You know, everything you do now, you put together a commercial for it, essentially.
Right.
So I did a lot of those. And Peter at the time was the head of the computer programming department. So he's actually got a lot of computer experience, and we just got to know each other and got to talking, and weirdly, he'd been writing a lot of scripts himself before then, and you know, that's what I was studying as well. And we never, when we set out, we never really set out to be partners. We kind of fell into it. Really weird story on that. When I was working as an exec at MGM for a while after, this is after the computer software company.
Oh, we'll have to talk about that too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was a studio exec, and I was also trying to find projects on my own to set up. And we had seen this episode of Dateline, right? It was Dateline, about the plane crash of TWA Flight 800, and ended up selling that story to Lifetime. But it was really much more Peter finding and identifying the story, because when he had worked after the computer software company, he did some computer work for Warner Brothers in their international department, and he was supposed to be on Pan Am Flight 103, the one that was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland.
Oh, wow.
He and one of his coworkers.
So it was personal to him.
Yeah. So the weird thing was that
skipping over so much fun stuff.
No, I'll let you talk in a second. Right. Then I'll just finish my quick story here. Then, but yeah. So we had seen the story, and it reminded him so much of his own experiences, because basically what happened is this woman's husband and son had stayed behind to close a business deal. It was kind of the opposite of what had happened to him. He stayed behind for a business meeting, and it saved his life. These people ended up on TWA Flight 800. So we sold that to Lifetime, and it was kind of the first thing that it made sense for us to work on together.
Well, let me just ask you, so because you guys went from one thing to another, so how did you, because I'm kind of one of those guys, our show is all about how, like, how did you do stuff?
Right.
Because a lot of people come on and go, then I got an agent, then I did, I'm like, no, motherfucker, how?
No. Right.
Like, that's right.
Yes.
So how did you get to Lifetime, and how did that happen? What was the process, if you don't mind me asking, either one of you?
Well, that one. I just want to mention one
thing
that I think is interesting is that I was an early computer nerd, you know, back in the day, and became a software engineer when I was 17.
Okay.
And that's
when
we got this company.
17.
But the part that's interesting is that we, when the company folded, not my fault, we went on to do our own things, and then, like Cindy said, she ended up working at Columbia, and I just happened coincidentally to be working at Warner Brothers, which is right across the street. So we sort of I was working in the international distribution division at the time.
Okay.
So we just happened to follow along the same tracks, and, you know,
kept running into each other.
Yeah.
And when we first tried, we actually had an opportunity to try to write a spec script together. And this is weird because all these years later, I just co-hosted an event at the Writers Guild with this woman. One of his mother's friends was a showrunner, I believe, on Cagney and Lacey at the time.
Cool.
And knew that he was, you know, a writer. So we were going to try to spec a script and have her take a look at it. You know, it's in this business, everything is about relationships and, you know, and having somebody do it. But our attempt to do that is we've had to learn how to work as a team together, because we literally argued about every single word before it went down on the page. We went to the beach one day to try to write there. We thought it would be a good, quiet environment.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Literally, we came back with a half a sentence after like 3 hours at the beach and a sunburn.
A total genius idea for a spec, and we literally never got through it.
And so we've learned the way we write together. I mean, I think this is about you talking about the process. The way we tend to work together is one or the other of us will take the lead on something. Sometimes I tend to do the first draft on things, although not recently, but just because I'm a little bit better at facing the blank page. And he's really great at polishing. I mean, we kind of have our skills kind of dovetail each other. We have different skills in different areas.
But see, that's we talk about a lot when we've had a lot of writing partners on. That to me is always the best writing partners, when somebody has a strength that you don't, or the access to, you know, to finish when you're closed, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, they just have something opposite to you.
Yeah.
It just usually works.
He's great at notes too, and but they're scary notes. Like, I always have to like brace myself for hearing what he has to say. But
well, I was gonna say, and she's also a lot better at letting me mess with her shit. You know?
You gotta be.
Well, I'm like, what the hell did you do to my scene? You know?
No. Sometimes, I mean, I tell this story. I teach screenwriting at the New York Film Academy too, and I tell this story sometimes to my class when they're telling me that they want to. They have a writing partner and they want to work together. I tell this is my funny story, which is that he and I tend to sometimes, you know, work in the same room, and I'll email my first draft baby to him.
And he'll email that he's in the same room.
Hours and hours will go by, and he's over there typing and typing and typing and typing and typing. And all of a sudden, I'll go, what are you doing? It was great. Don't change a word. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing all that typing? And he'll email it back to me, and I'll read it, and I'll go, oh, yeah, this is a lot better. Because he'll do it with the tracking on, so right, I see in red right, what he's changed and right, how he's changed it. So he's really good at that, and mm-hmm, I've learned to not be so defensive, yeah, and yeah, kind of, you know, conversely, I have my pluses too. We had an assignment that we were working on, a project we sold to Disney Channel a bunch mm-hmm of years ago, and it was a football story.
Oh, really?
And I'm a real sports fanatic. My dad, I was like an only child, and my dad and I watched football together all yeah, the time, and I know everything there is to know about mm-hmm football, and I'm like a football freak. Mm-hmm. He didn't like football.
Really?
So it was one of those things, because we're a male-female yeah, team,
sure,
and we'd be in a meeting with a bunch of people, and I would tell him before we went into the meeting, don't you dare answer any questions about football. Please.
Football questions, you
do
shut your mouth.
And
around,
it was hilarious because, you know, and it was a room of men and women, you know, various execs, and they would all look to Peter
look
with
yeah,
every,
yes,
you know,
football
and the football thing, and Peter?
Yeah. They all looked to Peter, and then I would pipe up, and the whole room, like, all of them would like, oh, you know, look over at me like, why is she talking?
Yeah, I did all the mushy romance scenes.
So, you know, we like to play against type, but I, like I said, I think we do have complimentary things.
Right.
I tend to sometimes write the action things, although lately he's been writing some great action. So, mm-hmm.
But to just back up, you asked a question about like our first projects and things
sure,
like that.
Like, how did you get it to Lifetime? Like, how did
yeah, well, I mean, just to even take a step back, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, like from, okay, you know, when I was in second grade. I have a yeah, quick funny story about, you know, I would go to the back, actually it was my second time in second grade because I flunked it the first time. But we had a computer in the back of our classroom, and I would like go back during the break, and mm-hmm, I'd be, you know, just back there like typing up a short story, and I got in deep shit because the teacher, like the break would end and the teacher would be like, you know, you have to take, you know, get back right, in the class, and be like, I have to find out what happens. And literally that was like, that was my, yeah, it's like, literally it was the first experience of like going, I actually don't know what the story is, it's telling me, you know, and the okay, muse takes over. Mm-hmm. So I love that whole idea. So anyway, as I said, I became a software engineer when I was in high school, mm-hmm, and then I started consulting for the studios, and I was making so much money, and I was flying all over the place.
Whoa,
it was really great.
Wait. Where my 10% at?
Okay.
But it's like, I wasn't right. I mean, I was actually, software writing is really similar in a weird way, but I wasn't doing what I wanted to do.
Okay.
So once the plane crash thing happened, mm-hmm, it really was like a wake-up call. And that's mm-hmm, when I found out about the Disney contest, which okay, back at that time was a feature contest.
Mm-hmm.
And the deadline was like, mm-hmm, what, 15 days away or something
mm-hmm,
like that. So
yeah,
I just got my shit together, wrote a script for it.
So you wrote it in 15 days?
I was probably less than that.
So that's what I'm talking about.
When
I
look
love
at
that,
it now, I'm like, yeah.
He does
like
this. He wrote.
That's how, yeah.
We had a project last year, the Brittany Murphy story that was on Lifetime. And he did the heavy lifting because the deadlines we were on, I was actually teaching a lot then. Mm-hmm. So he wrote 5 of the 8 acts and I wrote 3.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote it in 10 days. But we had 2 months to research it and
yeah,
do mm-hmm, like a really thorough 30-page outline. If you have a really solid outline...
We were just talking about that.
Yeah.
You can kick out the script pretty quickly because
right,
all you're doing is going in and you know, polishing it up
right,
and putting in the language,
right,
the dialogue.
It does depend on your process because mm-hmm, my process is, you know, waiting for a deadline to kick my ass.
And see, then you don't have time to bullshit and like some
you
people...
You
don't. It's
yeah,
like usually your best... I'm glad you
will sit
like
there
too,
for 12 hours if you
You will
to,
sit there and pump
yeah,
that out because there's no wiggle room for you, like, oh, let me think about this. I know it's like mm-hmm, it's coming. It has to get on the paper, and mm-hmm, usually it's your best shot.
And you
gets
use
on
a
there,
totally different part of your brain. Too.
Yeah,
you really mm-hmm, literally.
That's
if
his
you have
good
all
part
the time
of his brain.
I'm so glad there's someone else who works like that because I'm notorious for doing that too.
Because it's funny because I'm like a notorious overwriter,
mm-hmm,
and if you give me all the time in the world, I'll just overwrite.
Oh my
crap
god! Thank god! Yeah. I love it when there's
if
somebody
I don't
else.
Have time, like this, I know we're gonna talk about the pilot in a little bit, and that was another 10-day write, and it was just like I just had to get on the fucking page,
right.
You just write totally differently that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you really do.
And it works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, weirdly, you know, you're talking about the TWA Flight 800 project, the first one. I mean, I had just come off 5 years of working a studio job as a development exec at MGM.
Okay.
I worked in their TV division, This was while he was over in the international department at Warner Brothers, and we were still writing and doing things on the side, as you know. But with studio jobs, you kind of work crazy long hours. So,
are you allowed to be a writer too when you're?
I actually was. We're talking MGM here. Okay, the 5 years I was at MGM, which were in the 90s, the studio was up for sale most of the time I was there.
Okay, I
found out my first year there, I worked for the number two man in the company. I was his executive assistant, which was the best job I've ever had in my life. Because I was being paid like twice the salary of most of the other executive assistants. And he was so busy. He was actually had been the personal lawyer for 12 years of the head of the company, the CEO of the company. So he was in meetings all the time. All he needed me to do was sit there at my desk and answer his phone, which only rang about six times a day, and look busy.
Really?
What does a writer do to look busy? They sit there and write their own scripts.
Okay.
So I was being paid handsomely to sit there. And for me, he'll tell you, I'm really bad about getting up and running around. If I have the freedom to like be writing at home and I'm getting up and running around, I'll go to the refrigerator and get something to drink. I'll go make myself some coffee.
She's a procrastinator.
You know, I'm terrible about things like that. So the fact that I had to sit at my desk because the phone might accidentally ring, it was fantastic. I got more writing done that year than anything. But I found out the day of our company picnic on the 11 o'clock news that I was out of a job.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
In
the news,
We went to the company picnic, which I knew my boss had two young children that were really excited. The company picnic was at Calamingas Ranch, if you've ever been out there. They were gonna have a petting zoo and pony rides, and it was this cool company picnic.
Right.
And I get there and my boss and his kids are not there, and I'm like, this is not good. Then I noticed, because I worked in the executive suite then.
Ponies being packed up and stuff. You're like, I just got here.
No, they went on as if everything was okay. It turned out later, we were owned by a French bank at the time, Credit Lyonnais. Anyway, it was very funny.
Aww.
But long story short, I got home that night, found out the reason none of the CEO office people were there is because they were all getting fired across town in Beverly Hills.
Man.
So, I saw the TV and said, well, do I go into work tomorrow?
Yeah, what is that? How awkward is that?
And I went into work the next day and it got to be like 11, 11:30 in the morning. My boss hadn't shown up. And then he all of a sudden comes like creeping down the hallway and he comes up to me and he goes, do you think we're supposed to be here?
Like,
I don't know.
Like
I was hoping you could tell me. And I got to stay on there and work and eventually become, I got moved to the TV department. We worked on the Outer Limits series, bunch of Canadian made series. So,
well, it's interesting because you are, I've never told this to you, but you're one of those people that on the education committee, we have some serious veterans in there, you know, on our committee. And you're one of the people who stand out to me. I haven't told you that.
Thank you.
I know smart people when I see them. You are super smart.
Thanks.
And no, really. And of course, Peter's like, no, she's not.
I almost kicked you under the table.
and I mean that seriously. Just like whatever topic we are talking about, you are one of those people who have something to say. And when you say it, it's like you've thought about it and you're like, here's the answer. You know what I mean? You're one of those people for me.
Thank you.
And it shows in all of your experience and things that both of you guys have done over the years. And we'll talk some more. So I just find that really, really interesting.
Thanks.
And while we're on that, just so we don't forget, can we talk just a little bit about you running for the board?
Absolutely.
Just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
She's running for the board.
I'm running for the board. The Writers Guild board. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Luckily, the nominating committee saw fit to nominate me again. This is not my first run at the board. I came close last year.
Mm-hmm. But almost everybody who runs takes at least twice to get in.
Most of my friends who are on the board right now got on their second run. I came close on my second run last year. I was 11th out of nine. Nine people got elected, and I was 11th. Out of 18 candidates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wasn't that far off. So that's why I was debating about running this year, but I really decided there are so many important issues that I want to keep talking about. You know, one of the challenges is I'm the co-vice chair of the Women's Committee in addition to being on the Writers' Education Committee. And of the 400 people on our mailing list and who are on the Women's Committee, most of them are not eligible to vote. Because at a certain point, when you haven't worked enough, mm-hmm. you fall out of the ranks of being able to vote. Yep. And I'm lucky since mm-hmm. I joined the Writers Guild back in 98, actually officially in 2000, I was on the Animation Caucus. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other Oprah. Mm-hmm. Since I joined the Writers Guild, Peter and I both have managed to maintain current status. That means voting status mm-hmm. and ability to run for office. And a lot of the other women haven't. So, you know, I've run every year on the issue and topic of diversity.
Otherwise, you would have probably had the votes if they were able to vote.
Yeah.
Understood.
You know, we go through this process every year where you have to get people who are voting members of the Writers Guild to mm-hmm. endorse you. And that's a lot of how people decide who to vote for is, you know, what kind of important endorsements you have, who mm-hmm. who's endorsing you, how many people are endorsing you. And I went after a lot of the people on my committee last year to get those endorsements, and they were all like, I would love to endorse you, but I'm post-current, which mm-hmm. means not current anymore mm-hmm. and can't vote. So that's tough. That's what's tough for the diversity candidates in general, but I think it's so important to have diverse people on the board. Mm-hmm. We're lucky we have on the board a lot of our A-list feature writers and showrunners.
Shonda Rhimes, people like that are on mm-hmm. there.
She's not on the board.
Oh, she's not on the board?
No, she's on. She's the head of the diversity advisory group.
Advisory board. Mm-hmm. I knew it was a board. Something with a board.
Right. Yeah. But a lot of the folks who are on the board are our top level people, which mm-hmm. is great because that helps build a bridge
Absolutely.
To talking to mm-hmm. network and television network and studio execs. But what we also need are more middle class, diverse mm-hmm. writers mm-hmm. to understand the problems that Writers Guild members. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the best board. Jonathan Fernandez ran with me mm-hmm. twice and got on last year, and he's a voice for that. Mm-hmm. You know, having gone through some of these struggles, he, on a great movie he made last year, Rob the Mob, that had been set up at Lifetime, and he mm-hmm. got it back and made it as a small, low-budget indie feature, and at one point in time, because the budget was so small, they wanted him to just take an executive producer credit and not take a writer's credit, and he held his ground.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know, and people who've gone through those kind of struggles, right. I think those are the kind of voices that need to be right. on the board representing... Mm-hmm. You know, the 98% sure. of mm-hmm. us or 99% right. of us who are not millionaires.
Right.
Well, you and I
right.
were talking about something interesting that Lisa can chime in on, too, mm-hmm. is that we were talking about the being over 40, and you were saying that you actually talk about something else. You call it something else.
Experienced writers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's kind of one
the
of
seasoned.
The seasoned. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is important. I mean, here's the kind of crazy thing about our business. Who can afford to retire at age 39 or would want or would want to? I would be bored Please. Out of my mind sure, sure. if I had retired at age 39. Well,
right.
I
mean, especially if you put a lot of years struggling in initially to get into the business.
Yeah.
And for people who are diverse or a woman,
right.
It takes a little bit longer to mm-hmm. get where you're going.
Sure.
And I'm all about, one of the things that I kind of talk about as much as I possibly can is I really believe it's all on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is getting people to read. You know, I've noticed in the years that I've been in the business, it's more and more and more challenging each year to get people to read. And I know it's a time thing. Like mm-hmm. I said, I yeah. was on the other side of the desk. I was a studio mm-hmm. executive. Mm-hmm. I had a big stack of scripts on my desk, too, that I
right.
had to read.
Mm-hmm.
And when people would call a month later and wonder why I hadn't read it yet and gotten back to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would have to make my excuses about, hey, I've been in meetings, I've been in production on this, that,
right.
and the other.
Understood.
And mm-hmm. you know, I'm trying to get to it. I'm sorry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do know and understand that whole thing.
Right.
But it's still frustrating when you're the one waiting for somebody to read something of yours and you know it's really good, and
yeah.
if they would just pick it up and read it.
And my favorite thing is when you hear, you know, we were just looking for something like this 2 months ago. If I'd only read it then.
Yeah, yeah. That
and
right.
it's been
but
sitting on their desk for 4 months.
But you had it 2 months ago. you had it, though.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, so you guys did the Lifetime movie. That was your first, like, big break.
Oh, yeah. And here's the story on that one. It ended up for a green light on September 11th, 2001,
really?
A day when plane crash stories were really not very popular.
Mm.
And it still went through.
It didn't.
Nope.
It didn't?
Oh, it did go through.
After 3 years of being in development over there.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's actually worth getting into, like, how we set up that one to begin with.
Yeah, that's what
it was. That was a situation where we found out about the story. We went after the rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had.
So you guys reached out to the people?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. That's, we do, we're like the true story people. We, okay. We're pretty mm-hmm. good at like tracking mm-hmm. people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even people who don't want to be found, we find them sometimes. But
had the people for that particular story, that had they already had people approaching them already? Or did you guys beat everybody to the punch? We're like, oh, we got it, and go.
I think she did have other people approaching her. We had a real lucky thing. This was my exec job at MGM paying off at that time. Mm-hmm. I had been talking to the producer at Dateline of that piece, and she called me back when I was out to lunch, and my assistant took the phone call and realized that it was her sister's best friend who was the producer in New York, that they'd grown up together. So I had kind of an advantage.
Gotcha.
And for the next
relationships.
8 to 10 years, she would give Peter and me an advanced notice. She would send us an email or a link or let us know when a story that we might be interested in at Dateline would be there. And she actually made our Hallmark Hall of Fame movie that was on CBS, Crossroads, was a true story of a man named Bruce Murakami that was a two-hour Dateline special. Mm. She hooked us up with the producer of that piece, and we got to Bruce that way, and he's now one of our closest friends,
you know,
too.
That,
so proud of that movie.
That, I remember that movie. That movie means a lot to me because I lost... You see my Starsky and Hutch car sitting outside.
I did.
I was
going
to ask you about Starsky.
I lost my brother 5.5 years ago to a drunk driver.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I was driving
that.
Another car. So, and I don't drink or smoke or do drugs. Just never have. Just not my thing.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm like really sensitive about, somebody jumping in their car after they've had a couple drinks and just driving, whatever. And so that movie is really interesting. They were drag racing, and this kid was racing home. He stole his mom's, his aunt's car the night before, so him and his friends could go out clubbing. And they were coming home early in the morning. My brother was getting up early to go do something. And they were racing back to get there before she woke up.
Mm.
Oh. You know what I mean? And they were literally racing each other. Mm. You know, but he still was totally toasted, you know. Mm. Anyway, so that movie...
And even if he wasn't, just the whole street... Just a split...
80 miles an hour on the street.
Right.
Is how fast he was going.
Yeah, we live in the West San Fernando Valley area. Mm-hmm. And we had wanted to show that movie... and have the people whose true story it is come and speak, because they were doing that at our producer. Our producer, his daughter was at a school in Pasadena, and our guys came and spoke, and they showed the movie there.
Okay.
So we wanted to do the same thing at my daughter's high school,
mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let us, which was really a bummer. And 3 weeks later, my daughter's TA in her AP environmental science class was killed. Drag racing.
Wow.
He was drag racing like a couple of miles from my house. So,
and when she says our guys, we're actually talking about, we did the story from both points of view, from the kid who was drag racing and you know.
Can you just tell the audience, so in case they're wondering, what's the story for that, this piece you're talking about right now, so they'll know what you're talking about?
Oh, Peter, can go ahead and tell Peter a little bit.
About the Crossroads?
About Crossroads, yeah.
Yeah, it was literally about a man whose wife and daughter were killed by this street racer, and he was gung-ho on bringing the kid to justice who did it. And he literally chased him for how long?
3 years, and hired a lawyer because the DA's office was not prosecuting the kid. And he'd never seen the kid, expected the kid to be some punk, some unfeeling, uncaring punk. You know, maybe green hair, tattoos, whatever.
Right.
And when he saw this kid for the first time in court, he was a bookish, nerdy, straight-A student, never done anything wrong before. His parents were having to hold him up, and it had wrecked his life every bit as much as it had
wrecked
Bruce's.
And it was a split second. It was like literally he was at a stoplight, and there was some guy next to him. They sort of gave the nod, and they took off. Split-second decision to change.
2 o'clock in the afternoon, and Bruce's wife and daughter had gone to the grocery store. They had been together for lunch before that, and one of the toughest things, and yet one of the best dramatic things for our movie to really hammer the point home, was that Bruce came upon the scene of the accident.
Really?
And got out of his car and raced to try to... The car was upside down. His minivan was upside down and on fire. And we saw on the Dateline piece, they had news footage, because the news people were there, of him running at the car and being restrained by the firemen and the policemen holding him back, because he wanted to try to save them. And of course, there was nothing he could do. So
that's
he
a great
had
image.
To watch, you know.
So, I mean, he was literally out for blood, and it was destroying his life.
Right.
Going after,
right.
Just being obsessed with getting this kid was destroying his life.
Anger.
And,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay. So ultimately, he decided to forgive the kid. Actually went to the judge and talked him into reducing a sentence.
Really?
And then they became good friends.
The sentence was really community what? Service. They're still good friends to
actually,
this day.
They actually go around the country talking to schools.
Wow.
Because Bruce realized that, for one thing, it wasn't going to do any good putting this kid in jail for 30 years. He was looking at a 30-year prison sentence, mm-hmm. Two counts of vehicular homicide. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't going to do anybody any good, but he felt that this kid telling his story to kids his own age mm-hmm. was going to make a much bigger impact than if Bruce stood up there,
right.
an older man,
right.
and told the story.
Right.
So, you know, it was a win-win situation all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for us, the tough thing is, and this is as writers, you can't control it, the title of the movie ultimately ended up being Crossroads, A Story of Forgiveness. And we as writers are like, gee, I wonder how it's going to end.
Mm. Yeah.
We tried
yeah.
to talk them out of that one. So we kind of, and they do too, we kind of just shortened it to Crossroads.
Gotcha.
Now, you know?
But I mean, it was literally a situation where two lives were lost that aren't going to be coming back, and two more, and not to mention Justin's family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a lot more lives on the line because one could be going to prison and one could be just, you know, simmering in his anger for the rest of his
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At what point did you guys finally get the agents and stuff? Like, when did that happen for you?
Well, we had had agents going back to the whole time I was working at MGM.
So did it help being in that position? You knew since you were working with the...
Well, I'll tell you, one of the better agents that we had for a lot of years, because we switched mm-hmm. from the kind of smaller boutique agency that we had been represented mm-hmm. by to a larger agency, because I... In our writers group, a guy who was represented by a bigger agent, mm-hmm. he wanted to stop by my office at MGM on the way home from work one day because we were right on the way. So he came in and met with me, and about 10 minutes into the conversation, he just looked at me really intently. He said, I'm going to bet you're a writer too, because he knew that I was in a writers group with his mm-hmm. client, yeah. so that made sense. He goes, and I'm going to bet you probably have a script in one of those drawers over there. Why don't you just hand it to me?
Really?
And he said, and you probably have an agent right now, but you're probably not thrilled with your agent, because nobody ever is. But he said, you're going to be thrilled with me. Let me read your script. So I handed it to him. I mean, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'll be honest. I felt like for those 5 years I was at MGM, I felt like a lot of the time, he'll tell you this, that I was on the wrong side of the desk. I mean, I found myself in some precarious positions where people came in and pitched fictional stories to me, mm-hmm. where I was working on a similar story myself that was a true story, and I had to, thank God theirs was fictional and mine was true story, and I had right situations and a paper trail.
Right. Sure.
But, you know, you put yourself in a little bit of a tricky situation, and yet we have an exec we've been working with now who's at a network. And he got promoted from being an assistant to being, you know, a development exec now. And he's had 3 movies on his network.
Wow.
So he's managing to juggle both those. I mean, so in terms of giving people advice, I don't know. You know, there are pitfalls to it. I'm glad that I did it.
No, I've never actually heard that. I mean, it makes so much sense. You're the executive and you're a writer. And you're getting people pitch you to you all the time. And sometimes they pitch something that has a story that has a little vein and similar.
If you ever find yourself doing that, what I did is I cut them off really quickly and I said, I have to cut you off and here's why.
Okay.
And I would tell them too that, you know, the fact that I have an MFA in screenwriting from UCLA and had projects set up both at, you know, I had projects under option at the time, both at MGM and other places.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it clear to them that I was a professional writer too, okay. that so that they understood. And you know, I also put a spin on that, like, but hey, if we do find something to work on together, you're going to appreciate me being a professional writer because I'm also going to give you better notes.
Right.
And you know, I'm not going to give you one of those domino effect notes that people mm-hmm. who haven't written before do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm going to be more sympathetic that when I'm giving you a whole lot of notes, I know how much effort that's going to mm-hmm. take for you to, you know what I mean? I mean, I've worked myself for a lot of writers who have been producers.
Sure.
And I've almost always, I think, liked the experience because mm-hmm. I feel like they're coming from a more sympathetic point of view when they give you notes. And also maybe a more knowledgeable view. And if they go ahead and tweak your things themselves, sometimes they make it better. And I'm always for that.
Right.
I have to say also, just backing up, one of the reasons that we became the True Story People, and we were actually known at our agency as the True Story People.
Yeah. That's good. Find your lane.
The go-to people.
The main reason is, you know, we were young people with no credits. And our strategy then was, you know, get a hold of something and own it, and then they have we have something they want, and we come.
Come through us now.
So that was our strategy: is we get these great stories. We don't own the rights, but we had the shopping rights to them, and you know, get in front of the right people, and you have to come along with the package. And
that's went for the Crossroads story, when you went to that person, did you have like a no fee option? Like, hey, if we get paid, then you get paid. Like, or did you like scruffle some money together and like, hey, we can give you this little bit now?
We literally did a shopping agreement, just saying we had the rights for some period of time to exclusively to shop it. And then once we set it up with a production company, then they can make their own side deal.
Yeah. Because sometimes that's tricky. When we've talked in the past about doing bios.
We've never paid for rights, and I advise my students now. I just had a situation where one of my students came to me and asked about paying $10,000 to somebody for, you know, a one-year period of time to shop it. I said, for one thing, one-year period of time is really hard.
Yeah.
You might not get anybody to answer you back in 1 year.
Right.
So what's
an appropriate amount of time? Do you 2 year, 3 year, something? What do you do?
I think nobody will sign anything. I think 6 months used to be the thing, and it's too short a period of time. I think 1 year is what you want to do now with the ability to re-up. But you just want to make it a shopping agreement, but you want to make it exclusive, because we've gotten burned on that before. We had something we almost sold to Court TV, and we had producers involved in it. And all of a sudden, our producers get a call from Court TV that they've had another producer walk in with the exact same story. Because, you know, it takes a long time in things. Yeah. And the person whose true story it was, which the true story turned out to be kind of bogus to begin with. But that's another matter. But it was very frustrating, because it harmed our relationship with our producer, because we told her we had an agreement with him, and all we had was a verbal agreement. She refused to sign papers with us, and yet then she turned around and signed papers with somebody else, because she felt like we weren't getting an answer back quickly enough. And we were about to, we were that close to, you know,
it takes time, people,
selling it, and well, it ended up not getting made. So
that's why we have to have those agreements, because it's just, you know, a lot of producers are top-lining things now, and without any rights, and, you know, figuring they can get the rights in the back end. But
and a lot of people are doing ripped from the headlines too. That's becoming really common.
But as far as money for an option, I think it just depends on, you know, if there's people coming out of the woodwork trying to get the rights, you're going to have to, you know, step up. But so just
Luckily, you guys haven't had to do that.
No, because we were working in an environment where we found interesting stories in places that, you know, may not have made giant headlines.
We've also, in ours, we're smart enough to have aligned ourselves on every single project we've worked with because especially when we were starting out, we were the new people. We've aligned ourselves with very strong producing partners. On the case you were asking about, we never really answered you, so I'll hop back to it, about the TWA Flight 800 story. We got that set up with the woman who, her company owned 50% of Lifetime. It was Hearst. So, and they were making they were making 9 of the 12 movies for Lifetime every year. So they were kind of like the production entity. And she had a personal connection to the story when we went in and pitched it to her, which was that she had been in New York the night the TWA Flight 800 crashed. And her husband was here in L.A. waiting for her to come home, and her flight got delayed because of the crash. And he was afraid, because there wasn't a lot of news about it. He was afraid she was on it. And when she got off the plane, she didn't realize what had happened and what the delay was or anything else. And he just grabbed her and hugged her and, like, had tears in his eyes and was so glad she was okay. So she personally had been affected by the story, kind of the way Peter was personally affected by it with the, you know, the Pan Am Flight 103 that he almost ended up on. So that's always, personal connections are everything. So she actually sold it on a log line that she pitched out over lunch with her Lifetime exec. She happened to be having lunch with the Lifetime exec, just mentioned it, and was talking about setting a pitch meeting. We were so lucky. We never had to go in and actually do the dog and pony pitch to Lifetime, she came back to us and said, I sold it over lunch. And we're like, great.
All right, there you go.
But then,
happened a few times.
Then 3 years went by because they kept changing their mind about what they wanted it to be. So,
yeah.
And we were also dealing with Oliver Stone had sold a TWA Flight 800 project to ABC. So we were kind of competing with that. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
It is
interesting.
But yeah, and part of the thing with True Stories too, as I was talking about people, you know, breaking the doors down trying to get their rights. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very hard to find the people. Like these Dateline stories, before we got in with the producer, like that particular story, that was before we got in with the producer of Dateline. Mm-hmm. And it was literally, we had recorded the story and I was going through frame by frame looking for clues. Mm-hmm. And at one point she pulls out a piece of paper.
She had a letter.
It's on stationery and
her fax number. So we typed up a fax. I sent it on my MGM stationery, so she knew I was a legitimate person, and that's how everything happened.
We had another story that we were trying to track at one point. We were trying to find the people because they didn't want any information out there, and I did the same thing. So I was like, there's cactuses in the background. A truck drove by on the street, and so I saw what the area code was. Mm. And we just would piece by piece. This is what we have to do.
Oh, my God. You guys are like super serious.
The area code. Part of it took place in a hospital. So we're like, okay, it had to be that hospital. It had to be
I talked to the doctor. Remember, we found a doctor. And there are multiple times I've talked to doctors.
They're doing shit like you be doing.
Okay.
You should have seen.
We're PIs.
I missed a research.
We're private detectives.
No, Lisa is too. She wrote this script. You want to tell them? Go ahead, you can tell them.
But oh, my Blanco, the Grisaldo Blanco squad. Yeah, like we found the FBI agent that got her, and then like the lawyer. Like I was like piecing things together. I was going getting court transcripts, names of people who knew somebody. I
You're
was like
go to the country.
I was writing to the. I was going to Columbia, y'all. I was going, and then I knew somebody who knew somebody who said, "Yeah, you might not want to do that," because her cousin over here. That's not, and it was just. Like literally, but the thing is, you just have to take the time and do it and have that patience. Because when I was looking for that FBI, I was like, it's not going to happen. Like, oh, did he move? He got, you know, and it was just like a letter. And you got to remember, this is before really, not I won't say before the QP period, but before a lot of like executives and FBI agents were really into like social media and just getting connected with people. Mm-hmm. But just the letters and reaching out and getting people's business card and calling, what can you find out for me? And waiting for other people to get back to you. And then that moment when you finally reach the person. I mean, I almost literally couldn't even breathe once the person called me back. Like, I was tracking this person and finally called me back. Mm-hmm. Said, hi, you've been looking for me? And like, it was months. And like, almost started hyperventilating. I was like, oh my God, it's you. I've been tracking you down. I need to talk to you. And it was just like, oh my God! But that you just got to be tenacious because sometimes
when you
it's
find
just
them. They're not. It's not like we're ambulance chasing.
Yeah.
We had another story where we did the same thing, like just going through. No clues at all where this story took place until a camera swept by the local high school. I was like, I saw the name of the team.
Oh, the sports team. Yeah. What's the logo? Who's the mascot? I had to find that. So oh my God.
Yeah. In every single true story, I think it's taken us. And some people, I get so frustrated when people have ordinary. Common names. They need to have really unique names so that you can track them easier. And you know, a lot of them are just listed in the phone directories for whatever town
You'd
they're
be
in
surprised.
Because they didn't expect to be in the middle of a story like this. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not a celebrity and they're all of a sudden thrust into this, you know, this weird situation. You know, one story I ended up talking to the person whose true story is what it's her former employer who put me in touch with her mother in the Midwest, and I talked to her mom for an hour.
Oh my gosh.
It's become, I mean, I'll be honest, it's become easier now that we've had a lot of these true stories produced because, you know, then we can send them links to, you know, our trailers of our shows or the actual movies. You know, I've sent DVDs of our, you know, our Hallmark Hall of Fame movie to people so that they know who we are and what we're about. Because a lot of when you do get a hold of them, a lot of what you have to do is reassure them that you're the person that they want to trust with, because you are asking them to go with you exclusively.
Right.
That's, you know, I mean, and you have to explain to them why that is. You can't have multiple people showing up, you know, pitching the same story.
And what it is about their story that we want to tell. I mean, we literally had one girl that we hunted down. She said, I just don't want to be a drug addled whore on TV. It's like, no. That's, you know, literally said that.
Right.
So.
And that was a project we were taking to Lifetime. So I'm like, you know, Lifetime only goes so far. So, know, I mean, it's not like, you know, an R-rated feature film could be pretty spicy.
Right.
It's funny you say that. because you guys, to me, and I've only read one thing of yours, but you guys have a very dark, in this script.
That one.
The script that we're going to talk about later. Mm.
Hilliard, you know we did a thing called Puppy Love, too.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely, absolutely.
Also the preschool animation I'm working on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the kid show that went off Broadway.
Rugrats.
I have an awesome porn pitch, too. It's called Hung Jury. Oh. Okay.
I'm making a point that even though you guys write things like for Lifetime and Puppy Love and things like that, it seems like where you guys are really, your lane that I'm seeing that you really want to explore is a lot more darker. Like, honestly, I think you guys could write Better Call Saul in your sleep. Ooh. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Thank you.
No, really. I could see it just based on the tone and what's on the page and how dark it is and creepy. And it's just full of all this curiosity, which we'll get into.
Right.
But what I wanted to talk to you about really quick before we get into that is what are you guys doing now, like the Sundance thing and then the Humanitas Awards, you know, and then we'll get into that other part. Is that cool?
Absolutely.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, we just found out, I guess about a month or so ago, that we made the finals of the Sundance Episodic Story Lab. This is the second year that they've done this program.
Yeah, because it's like new.
Yeah. Now I know you, Hilliard, just happened to have been a finalist in the Sundance Feature Lab, which has been going for a lot of years and is really super prestigious. Right. And
mine was way back in 2003. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, hey, it never goes away, the pat on the back like that.
I still use it, though.
Absolutely, and as well you should. I mean, the bottom line is what we try to do is, you know, we have entered a lot of contests and been finalists or, you know, ended up winning. This one, they'll ultimately pick 10 people. We're not going to hear until like the end of August.
Okay.
Sure.
And there are a lot of other Writers Guild people that I know who are great.
Shout out to Michelle
and Felicia, right. on your Black Writers Committee, absolutely. And Adam Rodman, who's on Membership and Finance Committee with me, and Kat Coiro, who did a panel for me on writers' education. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know some fantastic people. I mean, I feel like we're in such great company. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they're only going to pick 10 people. Mm-hmm. There were over 2,000 people that entered it this year. We don't know how many are left in it.
Right.
We heard somebody said 40, somebody said 60, somebody said 200. I have no idea how many are left in it. But it was a huge cut, and we're really excited to be in it. And we're trying to use that to get momentum, have people look at the script, because we're really proud of the script. Mm-hmm. In the past 2 years, we've really switched our attention to pilot scripts, which is a lot of what everybody's doing at the Guild.
Here's the interesting thing, because you would think that they're already writing TV movies, that it would be an easy adjustment for you to get right into TV and get on staff in some sort. Of course, you guys are riding on a level where you probably should be starting off as producers anyway. But and that's not how TV works.
Right.
Unless you come in with the pilot and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. What type of challenges are you guys finding moving over into trying to get into TV?
It's just a whole different world. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though TV movies and series are on the same networks, it's a whole different world, whole different set of relationships. Mm-hmm. It's about exposure. It's almost like, you know, starting in a totally new field.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
You mentioned the Humanitas New Voices program. We actually, the pitch for this pilot that's now in the Sundance thing had been what made us to get to top 20 on that. And again, they only picked 10, and we made it to top 20, not 10. So that's tough. But then we also, the Writers Guild has for diverse writers a program called TV Writer Access Project that you have to have been at least mid-level staff or have two produced TV movies to even enter it.
Yep.
Mm. Hundreds of Writers Guild members enter it, and they picked 14. And we made that last year. And we've made some wonderful connections out of that. And some of our fellow honorees from that last year are on staff now. They got staffed over the past year and a half since the program was. Right. And it was run by Glenn Mazzara, who with Shonda Rhimes is the head of, he was the showrunner of The Walking Dead for a lot of years. He's showrunning Damien, the Omen
Crash,
follow-up, Crash, The Shield. I mean, he's just amazing. So he ran the program. He's one of the heads with Shonda Rhimes.
I keep trying to get him on the show. He's just too busy.
Advisory committee. Try him after end of August. We're trying to get him in Salon. You know, Marlene is, we've already talked to him about being in Salon. We have a wonderful thing the Writers Education Committee puts on for Writers Salon for members that's happening mid-September. So he's supposed to be back here then.
But the Writer Access Program was, in fact, we actually spent an evening with Shonda and her staff.
Did you?
Oh, it was really, it was really great.
I know, no like holds barred. She and her
so
staff came in.
So many stories that I'm not allowed to repeat.
No, we're not, but we learned a lot.
Learned
it was
lot
really great.
Scenes,
so. Yeah, so I mean, we've had a lot of things. So those are the things we're trying to do to transition. I actually did a writer's education program about transitioning, because there are so many, not only TV movie writers like us, because TV movies are dwindling.
I miss them though.
And are going to Canadian writers or non-union, because the, you know, the costs of them are coming down so much. But also feature. You know, since 2008, feature assignments have gone down by 85%. So there's a lot of feature writers trying to transition into TV. So there's wonderful.
It's the hardest time in the world to get into. Everybody and the mother's trying to get into TV right now.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, the way
so
to
many
do
more
it is
opportunities,
right.
And at the same time, there's so much more competition.
The way to do it is write really great pilot scripts, and we're not just resting on our laurels of this one. That was a completely different pilot script that we won Writer Access Project with last year. Peter's working on another
it's
one right
comedy.
Now.
That was that's
one
right,
in the
you
comedy.
Write comedy.
We won in the comedy category. I know you will not believe that when you hear this, but we think that's kind of one of the things that we're.
That's good.
That's our advantage, is that we can't be pigeonholed.
We went to UTA the other day, the three of us and a couple of other people on the board. And who was that who was teaching? What's his name?
Brent Forrester.
Forrester. He was amazing.
Yeah,
I loved him.
So cool. He worked on The Simpsons and The Office, and now he's doing a Judd Apatow.
He's doing like free classes at the Writers Guild. Anybody can go, and he's like teaching you how he runs the show and how he what are his secrets in a room, and really good shit. And so a few of us from the education committee went. And I said jokingly, I was telling him about the show I'm working on with Pam. And I said, yeah, it's a comedy, but, you know, it's a little more, you know, lighter. It's kind of like Bernie Mac, you know, and Everybody Hates Chris type of style, single camera, whatever. And I said, I like it. I said, I'm having fun. I said, I actually probably would rather be writing the type of things you guys are doing, more darker type of stuff. Yeah. And I said, well, we should switch.
That's right. Well, when you're specking a script, you get to pick your own, you know, wheelhouse.
Definitely. I love the job. It's cool. It's a good it's a good gig. And I get to write, you know, the episodes. I get to produce on the show. I mean, it's I can't beat that.
Live that dream.
So the bottom line is, we're just keeping writing. I mean, I think that's the best advice any of us can give anyone, is just keep writing and keep trying to get people to read. That's
get it on the page, because it's popping. Because this, when he sent this to me, like, he sent me your script last night, and he's like, go ahead and read it. And I was just like, in my reader mode, like, okay. So, you know, whenever I read, I'm like, okay, if I'm a reader and I'm just getting this, tell me a story. Because you know how hard I am. It's like, you get three pages and I'm out.
Most people are. I mean, that's the thing. You gotta.
By half the page, if I'm just like, and I'm not doing that. It's like, okay, get through it. And I was like, I said, can you ask them if we can read their script on the thing?
She has never done that.
I never do that. It was like, literally, like at the like three pages, I'm just like, hey, by the way, like literally like 7 minutes later, hey, can you ask them if maybe we can just read this out there? Because I think our audience would probably want to hear.
Well, look, since we're here, why don't we go on ahead? So do me a favor. One of you guys set up the what we're about to read. By the way, this segment we call the Don't Sleep on Them segment. This is a segment for those of you, some of you guys can submit to this if you want. We'll usually read like a cool little scene, usually like an opening scene or a cool action scene somewhere in the script. Usually doesn't have that much a heavy dialogue. Even though yours has some dialogue, we just like it so much we're going to read it anyway. So fuck it, we're going to read it. This is a segment we call Don't Sleep on Them, where it's like, don't sleep on this person. You got it. This is the next shit.
You need to be on this.
Right? Exactly. Cool. So let's tell the people what it is and give them a little blurb about what, you know, the log line, what's it about?
Sure. It's called Blood Brothers, and it is a really dark, edgy crime thriller. But we're not that into the idea of procedurals per se. This opening scene, you won't get too much of the main characters because they come in after this. Mm-hmm. But okay. It's really kind of a cool situation where it's very mysterious and we're not sure perhaps which brother is
okay
doing what.
You ready?
Ooh.
Here we go.
Exterior, ranch house, Buda, Texas, night. 20 miles south of Austin and yet a world away. Buda is the real Texas, and so is this house with its rusted cars and blocks on the lawn and oversized cross by the door. Contestant on TV. I like to bow a vowel, an E. Interior, ranch house, Buda, Texas, more crosses. A gun rack. Dead animal heads, antlers on the walls. Irene and Josiah Brewer, early 60s, in an ancient armchairs, watch an 80s-era TV console as they dig at frozen TV dinners.
There are three E's.
On TV, Vanna turns letters. Ding, ding, ding. I like to solve.
A stitch in time saves nine.
Irene shoots Josiah a dirty look. Over. Contestant. A stitch in time saves nine. Josiah stops eating, puts his cutlery down, sniffs.
You turn the gas off all the way.
And now we hear the hiss. Irene looks up at him, wild-eyed, just as the power cuts. Darkness, save for the fading ambient glow of the TV tube. Without missing a beat, Irene bolts for the gun rack, expertly snaps off safety and straps, and tosses a rifle to Josiah before brandishing a shotgun herself. A practice drill. They split up, taking cover at opposite ends of the room. The darkness is suddenly pierced by a blinding strobe light, accompanied by the shrill of an alarm system far too high tech and starkly incongruous with this humble home. Security lights flood the yard as steel barriers lower to fortify windows. He in?
Don't know how.
The alarm goes into a silent mode interval. Pin drop quiet. Irene and Josiah exchange a look. This ain't over. Then... pop, pop, pop. Door locks unsnap. Shades roll up. Security system deactivated. Josiah and Irene panic. Siege mentality. Deathly silent. Until a floorboard creaks. Irene spins, blows a head-sized hole through her early American china cabinet. Shards fly. The alarm resumes, deafening. Josiah, vigilant, panicked, breathing heavily.
You don't need to do this. You ain't thinking straight.
The alarm ceases, but the strobing continues, and with each flash, Irene sees a figure close in behind her husband. Josiah! She dives behind a couch, then risks a peek, sees, flash, an arm around Josiah's forehead, his eyes wide with terror, the glint of a blade. Flash, Josiah's throat laid open, drenched in blood. Flash, both Josiah and his assailant gone. The alarm resumes, jolting Irene, who sweeps the room with her shotgun sight. When the alarm stops, she hears the back door shut. Then all is deathly still again. God damn it, people. You know that's some good writing. Come on now. That's come on now.
It doesn't end well for Josiah.
Oh, my God. That the first three, because we didn't read the whole three pages, but the teaser, It does all the things that you and I love.
What's my favorite word in the teaser?
Okay, curiosity.
Curiosity.
Mm-hmm. I want to know, will you? Okay, that's not part of the song. But no, it does. Number one, it creates curiosity. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a mystery. Like, we don't know
what the
hell is going on. Because for one thing, we're in the middle of like, I mean, the very first line, it tells you, This is the real Texas. Come on, y'all. Y'all know what real Texas means. Okay? All right?
It's called,
rusted cars
it's called
on blocks.
Buda.
Okay? It's called, damn
Buda,
it,
Texas.
Look. Okay?
Yeah.
B-U-D-A, Buda. Okay, who? Come on.
A Buda.
This ain't Houston. This ain't, it's Buda.
It's a real place.
It is a real place.
Okay?
It's actually a suburb just south of Austin.
Yeah.
And oh, man.
We have friends who live in both places, so we've spent some time there and really know the area.
So, okay. And look at the setting. That we got You got the gun rack.
Mm-hmm.
You got the dead animal heads. So you know these kind of folk. Like intuitively you know. But then it's like it's this weird moment because it's like, okay, we see them, you know, we're thinking, all right, they're 60s. They got the old school. They didn't even bother to upgrade. All right. And they're watching, come on, how common and homely is watching, come on, Pat Sajak? Mm-hmm. And you're eating TV dinners. Don't nobody eat TV dinners, old school TV dinners anymore.
True.
But they even have the nerve to have the little TV dinner, little things to sit in front of the TV set. And this is where you know, like, okay, you think you know this world, and then all of a sudden, Irene bolts for her gun rack. Okay? Mm-hmm. It said, now listen to the wording. It doesn't say Irene gets up and runs. It says she bolts. Mm-hmm. All right? She's in her 60s, people.
She's in her 60s. Yeah, I was thinking.
Okay, she's in her 60s. All right? Mm-hmm. Then it says expertly. Okay? Expertly snaps off the safety straps and tosses a right. Okay, 60s. Mm-hmm. This is Nana. Watching Patch Sajak eating TV dinners, jumps up, so you know they've been, and then you're wondering, what the hell are these people doing out here in Butte, Texas? And not only that, it engages you, and it automatically makes you want to turn that page. Because on the bottom line, on the first page, when Irene says, he in, you're like, who the fuck is he? Mm-hmm. Who is in this house? And automatically, I'm already want to turn.
You want to turn.
I mean, see what happens.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
That's some damn good writing. Like, if I was like a reader, like, I'd be like, okay, you know what? We go ahead and put this on the good pile over here. We're not even going, okay, we want to move it over here.
That's the objective, too.
I mean, it's just, and then you have like the, on the second page, you've got like the whole, I mean, you're still curious because you're like, they've got like this whole security system. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, the horror person in me and the darkness stuff is like, oh my God, this is almost like,
yeah, because it kind of rides
the Lamsey kind of thing.
The line a little bit.
Yeah, it's like, this is some hardcore stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got that, the strobe light action, the flat, and that, I mean, it's so visual. Like, as I was reading it, I could like see it, like that flash strobe, and you're like, you see that knife go across, and then it's like, Josiah? Are you all right? And I'm just like, whoa.
Now, guys, it's a really strong opening.
Oh, thank you.
Like you said, it's like super visual. Mm-hmm. There's just lots of little, I love like pop, pop, pop. You know, just lots of little things that make your eyes draw to the page. You know, lots of like, the alarm goes into silent mode interval. Like just lots of little small things that a normal writer wouldn't know how to write that.
Well, a lot of it is trying to play you with contrast too, because the quiet is as terrifying as the noise. The light of the strobe is as probably less terrifying than the darkness between the flashes.
Right.
And that's where all stuff happens.
Peter did the first draft on this one. And the heavy lifting on the writing in general, and he's a director.
Sure.
So that's what I, you know, he's really like tapped into his director side
of it. You can see every shot.
It's very visual. And he was a directing finalist in Project Greenlight a few years back. So, you know, I think that's
comedy.
Really on a comedy, yes. He writes a lot of comedy, but this is not one.
Okay, did you lose against my man who did Feast or what?
What's that?
Did you lose against, what's his name who did Feast?
Oh, the Feast movie?
No, it was actually the year before Feast.
Oh, the year before that.
No,
okay.
The special effects dudes. And, you know, that's one of those contests where you actually don't want to win. You want to be one of the finalists and you don't want to win.
That's what I said all the way through. I was like, I want to be top three.
And then that's it.
I don't want to be the subject of a reality show where they want to make you
They will make you look like a moron. That's what that's reality
is. It becomes like a reality TV show. It's like, I went, oh no.
Yeah.
But
let me say one other thing.
Go ahead.
One of the things I love is not only do you keep us curious with, like, Lisa was on the right track. The whole setup, it seems like an older couple sitting there in their home. Because it felt almost like, even though it says ranch house, I kept feeling like it was like a trailer home or something. One of those ones that's just propped up on the blocks or some shit. But I was picturing this house, and you set up the couple, and I was picturing when she picks up the shotgun and expertly does what she does, he gets his and expertly does what he does. They break off. Like, we've done this before. We are ready. The alarm went off. It's time to get into assassin mode.
And who are these people who have to do this again?
Who are these people who know how to do this?
Well, now they are Texans, though. So you have to, you know, they know their guns.
Yeah, but they suddenly become like James Bond or MI6.
Yeah. So I thought they were, whoever was coming in, they were going to go into a big old gunfight. And instead, whoever comes in is better than they are.
Right.
First, they take out the guy. And I'm like, okay, cool. So we got her. She's the hero. That's what I thought. Curiosity again.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, we take this bitch out. I was like, okay.
She is not making it. And then, and not only that, but then now you're kind of put into a position where, like, who do I fall? Everybody's dead. I don't know what's going on now. And now I'm hooked. Mm-hmm. I'm automatically. And even when you have to go into the next scene and you're doing the setup and you're being introduced to our protagonist, and even then you're still not knowing, you're still engaged because, one, you're like, people are treating this character like they've seen him before, and he's like, no, you've never seen. So curiosity, it's they're like literally teasing it out so that you really have to like I'm not going to get up and go get a snack during the commercial break, and if I do, I'm going to be sprinting and then coming and then I'm going to come right back to figure out what is going on.
Sure.
And
not allowed to eat.
And the fact that you do that, because like of course, Baby Riders. This scene probably would have went through like maybe 5, 6, 7 pages just to get that one thing.
Oh, yeah,
but this happens, boom. I mean, looking at it, my eye going down the page, clean, you know, no, that black's just boom. This happens. And then it's like, he in? You know, that button at the end, that great line at the bottom. Mm-hmm. I'm like, who's in? What? And then automatically I'm turning the page. Mm-hmm. That's like brilliant.
Well, like I said earlier, I'm a notorious overwriter. And mm-hmm. and this was one of those situations where I just wanted to get down real fast.
Yes.
And that was sort of fighting that, mm-hmm. you know, tendency to go.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of words will work here.
Where did this story come from, by the way? Because it's a trip.
We were forced to come up with, I'm going to tell it, because we were forced to come up with a pitch really quickly when we made the finals of the Humanitas New Voices program. We made it with a different pilot script. Mm-hmm. One of those true story things.
Right.
And we had to come up with not one but two pitches very quickly because we were being called in person and had to pitch it in mm-hmm. person. Mm-hmm. And I remember this was a story that he had been kicking around for a while, and I said, we should do that one. So he, you know, worked it out. We talked it through, and then we went in and pitched it, and we got such an incredibly positive reaction from them.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like, they were really surprised. We haven't even really told, I don't know if you want to tell the log line of it all, because it's very unusual. Should we tell the or is that
He's
too
like,
complicated?
Do I remember it?
He's like,
yeah, I know.
Like, do I tell? It's yours, so I don't want to step on your toes.
Well, I mean, just, I don't know what law, which there's a, anyway.
About the, you know, the.
It's basically about a kid whose DNA is found at several murder sites, and he doesn't know how it got there. And there's a very high concept reason why his DNA is there, and that's was sort of the
that's what everybody flipped out over. Yeah,
okay.
But it's that high the high concept part of it is what I'd come up with originally, and the weird thing about that was I was like, okay, what do I do with this? This could be a Disney Channel sitcom mm-hmm. easily. You know, so it's like, what framework do we put this concept in? And mm-hmm. it just ended up getting darker and darker and darker. Mm-hmm. And you know, like Cindy said earlier, I don't love procedurals. There's mm-hmm. not really, you know, but this sort
no,
sort
it
of,
feels really character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's what it's meant yeah. to be. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's got a sort of a procedural element to it as okay. far as the series goes, mm-hmm. but definitely way more on the side of developing the characters out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But oh, yeah, it could have been, like I said, it could have been a sitcom. Right. I mean, it could have been, you know.
Had you let tweaking. Him,
go ahead.
If you want.
Had you let him stay
in the
comedy,
it's a really
comedy,
juicy
right?
part for an actor. It's basically these two who did not know each other existed mm-hmm. actually find out over the course of the pilot that they're brothers that were raised by completely different families. So there's mm-hmm. a little bit of nature versus nurture going on. And mm-hmm. it's the idea of IVF these days that twins, identical twins, could be born 7 years apart due to frozen embryos.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what
and
it
raised
is.
It's in
basically
different
yeah. it's two identical twins, except they're not identical.
They're not identical.
One's 7 years older than the other one. And
what?
And they both the went to the same.
And the older one's in the throes of mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the younger one is starting to show to exhibit signs of right. mental illness. So you there's know, a lot of like, who really is the serial killer?
Right.
Is it either of them?
Right.
And what is their relationship going to be? And the woman is sort of caught between them, who
criminology professor. They've both over the years gone through the same criminology program at UT
wow.
Austin, and end up with her. And so there's a love triangle of sorts, mm-hmm. you know. Okay. But the question is, you know, in colleges, and I actually knew some people who had. Some mental illness problems in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, college, the stress of college often causes schizophrenia
yes.
or borderline personality disorder. I had a student recently with that. You know, bipolar mm-hmm. disorder, to kind of go full blown.
Right.
Because the stresses of college kind of put that.
I had
and
a good friend
age,
that's gone through that.
Well,
so
it's also
I
kind of the
that.
Age realm. So.
Right.
You know, that's...
So, yeah, so is the younger brother destined to follow the same footpath? You know, that's where the nature mm-hmm. versus nurture mm-hmm. aspect comes in.
Okay. Yeah, and there's a lot of... It
Can
is
you
very
change
character.
Your future?
There's a lot of character ramifications for our main character, who's the younger of the two brothers, finding out who he is and that he hasn't known who he is all along. There's some identity issues mm-hmm. and the ramifications for his other family members because of it. And
mm-hmm. No, it's tight. You know, it's... Like you said, unfortunately, we both only got, you know, a few pages in. But I'm going to say
I will know because I want to wait like, the rest,
I look
the rest
forward,
of it.
Well, hopefully we didn't spoil too much of it.
No. It totally made sense because you left me at a place at the end of the teaser on curiosity. I wanted to keep reading. I was like, why is he bloody? He doesn't even know why he's bloody. So why the fuck, you know what I mean?
And how how the other people are reacting to him and he's like, I don't know you, B-Ball. Mm-hmm. Why are you talking to me like you know me? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like that kind of thing. It's like, yeah.
And then if all goes well, you get to the end and go, what the fuck happens next? You know,
oh,
which
so
is the,
that's
response we've got.
That's the goal.
Yeah, that's what we're
definitely
saying,
is the goal.
No, but we wanted to read that for the Don't Sleep on Them segment.
Mm-hmm.
I love to do it when a guest comes on and they're here and then we could talk about it and people can see the caliber of people we have on the show. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know what I mean? And you see,
you don't just grab anybody off the
street. No. And people know Lisa and I
write scripts, come here.
People know Lisa and I are really picky about writing and stuff like that, as you guys are clearly. And so when we read something, it's got to be something we usually we read it cold.
Yeah, most of the time we don't I don't even want to know what it is because I want my reaction to be exactly how it is if when I'm reading for programs or anything like that. But it was like when he sent it to me, he's like, "Well, read it some." Oh, okay, and I just got back like from the beach, and I was just like, "Oh, okay." Get comfy. Got the little dog. All right, we're about, be still. I'm about to read. And then I was like, and third page, I was like, can you please ask them if
that's
we can read
reaction.
This? Can you ask them if we can read this?
Thank you guys so much. I'm so excited to hear that. I mean, that's the thing. The tough thing is, and this is like, you know, going back to me running for the board, this is one of the things that I'm trying to encourage. You know, we can't make studio or network execs read.
No.
They just, for whatever reason, they don't want to read, and it's really hard to get them to read. And hey, I used to do that. I used to be a studio exec, and my reading was at night or on weekends on my own time. And they all have kids who play soccer and, you know, have laundry to do and grocery shopping. And I understand why they don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And we all know that sometimes, like you were just saying, scripts aren't that gripping or aren't that good.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, people have the ability to stop reading at a certain point, too.
I mean,
you know, read 5 or 10 pages in and then say, okay, this is not grabbing me.
Yeah. And that's why people like myself and some of my other friends, that's why we're making our own sizzles and trailers and stuff. Just like, you're an executive, you don't have, let me show you this little 3 minute right quick.
And people are more likely.
They're like, well, it's only 3 minutes, I'll take time for that, but I don't have time to read your whole script.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
What I'm trying to do, too, one of the things that I, when I get up on my little soapbox for running for the board is trying to encourage some of the people. I mean, the nice thing about the Writers Guild is that a lot of our members are the hiring folks.
Yeah.
They're writer producers, they're showrunners, especially now that 75% of our membership are writing in TV, on TV series, and only 25% in features.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more of us, Writers Guild members, who are hiring each other. So I just try to, you know, wave my flag and, you know, and you know, this... the silliness of, you know, what age you are or what color skin you have or what gender you are, anything else. It should all be about being on the page.
Right.
You know, I have my little quote on my Facebook page is, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because I really feel that's the case. But it is challenging because people have to take their own time. And just hearing, you know, even how you're home from the beach and how reluctant you are to pick it up and read. But it's so exciting.
She also knew I'm not going to give her something bad, though.
I know. He's like, take this. I'm like, sure. I'm going to. And I'm like,
I was comfy.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
But you know what? That points out something, too, is you need somebody to kind of talk it up and get people to read, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we can all kind of do that for each other more. I mean,
that's why we're in the competition. You know, that's why the Sun Dancing is so great.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, to get the recognition, to get somebody to pick up the script and read it.
Right.
Well, here's the irony is... Lisa read the first 3 pages. I read the first 3 pages and said, let me send it to her.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
I love that.
And usually, I don't read anything, but I was like, well, let me just see if there's a passage in here that I can find. And I usually start at the beginning, and then I'll look through and see if there's a cool scene that we could just read, you know, just to be like, wow, look at how great this is, and let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And then, but I just read the first 3, and I went, I'm just going to send it to her.
It's like, I'm going to get a cold read.
Well,
all right.
This is the advantage of having been a reader. And Peter was a reader for years. We both read for NBC. We both read for a bunch of production companies.
Sure, we did.
In addition to, you know, when I was working as a development exec at MGM, too. The advantage of having done that is we know how important it is to grab people in the first 5 pages.
Right.
The first 3 pages.
Yeah.
Whatever. You need to grab people and, like, root them to the seat and make them read the rest of your project. So... You know, I mean, I tell this to my students, your first, you know, 3 to 5 pages have to be really killer great, set up a whole lot of stuff, mm-hmm. mostly the characters mm-hmm. and the concept, and get that across and what the conflict's mm-hmm. going to be. But then I say after that, then every page after that needs to be just as good.
Right.
Because it can't fall off
the ground. You guys have like two big reversals in the first 2 pages. You kill off the first two people we meet. Usually the first two people you meet you think are important.
Right. You know, or at least one of them is going to carry on to the next, you know, after the teaser.
Yeah. You killed off the first dude and I was like, okay, so it's her story.
I'm like,
that's where I start getting a little worried because I go, okay, now does it read like a procedural?
Like, none of them made it past the teaser? The what?
Yeah.
Because as a pilot, one of the things I'm always teaching people when they're writing a pilot is you have to establish, you know, that this is kind of the format of the show. Mm-hmm. If there's any gimmicks or any tricks or anything you do, mm-hmm. me as a writer on the staff is thinking from the pilot, so we always open on something happening like this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I don't know if that's how you guys want to continue going with the show.
Well, we're dealing with a potential serial killer, so there's a lot of killing that can go on. Also,
absolutely.
When Peter sets up the criminology professor, she consults for the Austin, actually the FBI, isn't it? The Texas Rangers.
Yeah.
Sorry. So she's going to have cases like that. They're not all necessarily going to be this specific serial killer.
Right.
But, you know, so that's, I think there's a lot of fertile ground. There's the mm-hmm. ability to make it procedural, but I think it should be clear from reading this pilot that it's always going to be meant to really move the characters forward. The only thing that, you know, we've had a few people read it, the only thing that people have compared it to was the earlier season of Hannibal. I don't know what happened with...
Okay, I can see
it's
that.
It's gone in a little bit of a different Hannibal direction. A yeah, but in terms of that relationship between Hannibal and Will and just the darkness of the whole thing.
I mean, it's very the character development and the savage things.
Right. Very different. And there was a woman involved in that early on. I mean, the early part of that, it's kind of, you know, gone in a different direction now. But that's about the only comparison. But we liked that. I mean, it was intriguing.
But that's why the setting sometimes changes it. You know, that's why you have NCIS New York, and then you have Miami, then you have, you know what I mean, whatever, so that you can change the setting a little bit, and it feels a little different, even though it's the exact same format.
Well, there's so much to work with in Texas, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really vibrant area, and
Austin is a really cool city.
And you've got that music scene in Austin?
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, that food thing. The food trucks there. Yum. I mean, and
don't
the bats.
Okay.
The bats flying out from under in the summer.
All
the
right,
bats
we just
fly
set
out.
The show there because we want to hang out in Austin, okay? We
yeah.
Oh,
one of,
my
one
God.
A really close friend of ours, somebody Peter used to work with at Warner Brothers, actually lives there now. And so, you know, when we've visited... it's just a cool place. The whole area is cool. I mean, I like San Antonio
down
there
in Houston. October for this new movie that I'm producing.
Yeah.
So we opened the offices in like September, so we'll see.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember during the heat.
Yeah.
Air-conditioned offices, hopefully.
Well, thank you guys, Cindy, Peter. We appreciate it.
Yes.
Thank you guys for coming on and hanging out with us.
Awesome.
You know, giving the kids some game out there.
Yeah, and good luck with the script.
Them,
we need it as a TV
them hear
show.
About your script.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope and wish you guys can get on a show because you guys should be producing on the show.
Mm-hmm.
You guys should be at that
Thanks.
Level.
Mm-hmm.
No
Thank
doubt.
You. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. We would love to. I mean, I think there's so much exciting stuff happening in television,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. And good luck on Sundance. That's going to be huge.
Sundance.
You know, that'll really open up a door, I hope.
I hope. That would be great.
You know, definitely.
Fingers
it's
crossed.
It's one of those, it's an honor just to be nominated.
Right.
It's
true.
Yeah.
It's
right.
true. We're
sure.
Yeah,
right.
working at what we can.
Yeah. Yeah. So
where can people find you? Where are you at?
Well, people can find me at the Writers Guild all too often.
Now, man, are you on
anybody who's a Writers Guild
Twitter?
Member, please, you know, endorse me. I'm actually on Facebook. We're both on Facebook.
Okay.
That's probably
Are you under Cindy or Cynthia?
Cynthia,
okay.
Yeah. Got a cute little picture of the Pomeranian
Aww.
On there.
Aww.
Well, what about you?
Facebook also.
Same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's another guy who has my same name who is a Nobel winning prize winner from...
Switzerland.
Physicist.
I thought that was you.
Yeah. It's not,
not you.
No.
I would have said,
I'm
said
not
that
the
too.
Scientologist okay. and the other one.
Okay. Yeah. We keep saying we're gonna do a website someday, you know, and put up Peter's short films and you know some of our stuff. We just have
we
unfortunately
have
been
under
too
construction.
Yeah, I was gonna say we've been
Mr. Computer
on.
Dude over there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. He's been busy writing. He's put his writer's hat on, you know.
Yeah.
Get it in. And where are you at, Lisa? Where can we find you?
Oh, I'm always on the internet. Most likely you'll find me on Twitter. I don't know why I'm laughing while I'm looking at you. He's sitting there stroking his chin.
She's
like,
still got
yes.
That sunburn, tiredness. I see
you. No. Yeah. Hey, no, I'm on Twitter under my name. I'm also, you can find me on Bitchflix, where I do a lot of film criticism with a feminist intersectional slant, usually every 2 weeks. So, you know, check me out. I'm always on there. And you can always find me on the hashtag either on Friday day or Saturday nights. You can find me on Saturday Night Sci-Fi or Friday Night Horror.
Exactly.
So join us. It's free. It's fun. It's just watching movies and horror movies or sci-fi movies and, like, talking about it and talking at each other globally. So it is fun.
They be getting in with the black girl nerds and Geek Soul Brother and all them. They be going. There be thousands of them going.
Oh, there's one that's coming up. Oh, God. It's probably going to be too late, but we're... Black Girl Nerds, and also I think it might be, I can't remember the other person is doing it, but they're doing, oh, it's under the hashtag is 80s live tweet.
Okay.
And the movie that we're doing, listen to me, the movie that they're doing on the, oh God, I think it's next Saturday, but we're doing, and join us, it's going to be The Lost Boys.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's a classic.
So it's combining two things, the 80s stuff that we love and also the horror stuff. So check out the 80s live tweet. Just hashtag 80s80 and then a small
We're going to miss it because we're dropping something else tomorrow.
No, that's fine. It's totally fine.
But we can still promote it.
But they always have an 80s live tweet. There's always an 80s live tweet. So just look for that hashtag and find out when the next one is. But it's always a lot of fun.
All right. That's what's up. Cool. And I am your host, Hilliard Guest. And you guys can find me on Twitter. I say Twitter like I'm cool and shit.
He's trying to do his fake British accent.
Speaking of that, Chris Derrick just walked in over there. The popular Derrick Brothers writing team. Anyway, you guys can find me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest, so you guys can follow the show at ScreenwritersRR. If you guys want to send us anything, ScreenwritersRantRoom@gmail.com. Special shout out to a couple of the top countries. We are all over the place right now. Of course, United States number one, UK number two, Australia, Japan, Brazil, Lithuania. I'm always shocked when I see that word.
Huge.
Like Lithuania, Canada, you know. Anyway, so just a few. Brazil, you know, a few of you guys. We love you guys. We appreciate the support. And everybody in the States, we love you too. So we do this little thing that she didn't do at the beginning. Well, I say we keep it 2015.
Sometimes I'm just blinded by
you
the
guys
blame.
Are going to join in with me on this.
In case I mess it up is what you're telling me. That's what you're really saying.
Exactly.
That's the subtext.
So on the Rant Room, we keep it street. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what?
2015.
Y'all didn't even join in.
See?
2015. Yay.
Peter over there, like he can't say it.
Peter still didn't come
Fail.
In.
Fail.
And one last thing, shout out to the Hatchery for letting us, you know, work out here. The Hatchery Press over here in Lockmont.
Please come take advantage of the space. It's wonderful.
Love it.
It's wonderful.
Peace, y'all.
Ciao. Just spill it and anybody can get it. No limit. We get to kill it. You tuning in to the thrillers. And no, ain't no stopping. Any topic, even the random. We get to win. I hope that you're ready. We entering in the zone soon. We on a grown shit. Welcome to the Rant Room.
That's it. That's all I got to say.